This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 451 for February 8th of 2019. Will the internal combustion engine survive? Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, Gary, we get to do a show.
We do. You know, I was thinking, so yesterday here in Detroit, we had an ice storm.
Yeah.
And I had about like a quarter inch of ice on the vehicle that's parked in my driveway. Today, it's like pea soup out there, fog. And I was wondering, gee, if I had an autonomous vehicle, could I have gotten around anywhere yesterday or today?
Yeah, after you took a hairdryer to all the sensors.
And the roads.
Yeah. Okay, we got to let everybody know we've got Phoebe Howard-Wall from the Detroit Free Press with us here. And Phoebe, great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And our special guest, as it were, Brett Smith from the Center for Automotive Research. And what's your exact title there?
Oh, now it is Director of Powertrain Technologies and Energy Infrastructure.
Okay, perfect. This is why we want to do
there we go.
The show. Because we want to talk about powertrain and what's the reality and where things are going. And so I'll just start it out by this. How long do you think? And this is all opinion. You don't have to worry about facts and all that. You know, we trust your opinion here. How long is the internal combustion engine going to be around?
Long, long time.
So long, you know, some people would say 2028 is a long time.
No, it's realistically, it's going to be tough for the internal combustion engine not to be around for the next several decades. And we're talking just over the last couple days and week here, the gasoline engine, gasoline or diesel, does things in cold weather that batteries struggle with. It does things that we're used to that work really well. It's a really effective way of transportation. Battery technology is getting better. Electric vehicles are absolutely wonderful. They're potentially the future, but it's still a tough bogey to beat an ICE engine.
So why do you think several decades, number one, and number two, if you look at companies like Volkswagen that basically say in 2026, that's the last engine they're going to develop. This doesn't mean they're going to stop making them, but they're just not going to put more resources into developing one.
So engine program will last 10
years.
12 to 15 years.
Right.
So 2026, 2040 is when that engine would sunset probably.
Okay. So that's just like a couple of decades.
I said several.
So what do you think, Brett? You know, clearly electrics are going to catch on more and more. ICE is going to be around a long time, but it's going to tail off at some point. Do you think 2040 is the point where it starts to tail off?
It is so difficult to guess right now, and it is a guess for all of us. There are certainly things happening in the electric vehicle world, the battery development world, that make you think, things could change quickly. But again, I come back to the gasoline engine's a really tough bogey. It does a lot of really good things. If you put a mild hybrid on that, or even a hybrid on that, you've got something that is really, really tough to build or to beat.
So on that note, very, very quickly, you just hear again and again that the hybrid is the best of all worlds at the moment. The technology isn't where it doesn't meet the comfort level for the consumer. And when people go out for a run and their phones die, a little phone battery can't sustain the temperatures nationwide right now. How does that not instill fear in the drivers?
So I think, Phoebe, there's two parts to that. One is the hybrid being the solution. And a lot of models that might work, you get more and more in the last couple of years, a year maybe, of companies saying, we've come to the point where we believe that there's too much cost in having two powertrains.
Okay, so that because it's not the efficiency, it's the cost question,
and the
efficiency is good in the hybrid, but yeah, you're saying just pivot. Once you go that far, go all the way.
That's what you start to hear. That's always been kind of background noise, but over the last year or so, I've heard that a lot more than we have in the past. I think Volkswagen's announcements over the last couple of years on them moving to all electric. Chevrolet, I see behind you the Volt. Chevrolet saying 2 months ago, we're moving away from the Volt in part because it's too expensive with two powertrains. Those kinds of things make you think that the hybrid model, which a hybrid idea, which is a really logical pathway for a lot of reasons, maybe a shorter lifespan than we'd thought.
Although, to be fair, Toyota just announced that the new Corolla is going to have a hybrid. I mean, and so here's a company that has tremendous manufacturing efficiency, right? And we've not heard them say once that they believe that this cost inhibitor is in any way, shape, or form affecting their product.
But that's Toyota, right?
Right.
I mean, Toyota's all in with hybrids. And I would say to a degree Honda, too. You know, but you don't hear that talk from other car companies.
Right. So it gets back to this thing. And Brett, in your previous position before you had this new title, you were studying manufacturing and doing research on automotive manufacturing and the footprint. And I mean, isn't much of this predicated on the sunk costs that automakers have right now? I mean, they all have big engine plants, and there's very little interest in saying, you know, maybe we ought to switch this out and do something else.
So there's interest in saying you're going to do that. It's great marketing, it's great publicity, and it's great visioning. The question becomes, when does that sunk cost, when does all that investment become obsolete? And are we ready to make it obsolete? Can we make it obsolete? I've told John this before, I think. It's a great time to be in our business because all of us get to study this fascinating transition. And I tell people, grab a bag of popcorn, sit back and watch, because this is going to be a really fascinating time.
I have one question for you. Based on your expertise, one thing that Volkswagen said in their last big annual meeting is they're getting ready to ratchet up all the battery production, but they know they can't transport batteries for safety reasons, for all the reasons we have to worry about batteries on airplanes. So they're trying to figure out where to put the new battery factories. Where do you see any of that being domestic? Do you think America wants battery factories, or does all that go up someplace else? Because they need to be near the cars, they said.
So the Center for Automotive Research has done quite a bit of research on the new trade tariffs and such. And in some of the new NAFTA, the formerly known as NAFTA, in some of that, there is very specific ways of leading into getting investment in batteries in this country. It is going to happen partly, a little bit because of that, but more so because, Phoebe, what you talk about, it does not make sense to ship these in the quantities and the scale overseas for a lot of reasons. You will see, I think, regional development of maybe you'll have global technology leaders, but you'll have regional development of the manufacturing systems.
Didn't Volkswagen say Chattanooga's going to have a battery plant?
They're going to build a whole new assembly plant to make electric.
Right. So
I believe that does include a battery.
They haven't announced. They actually, when I asked that, one turned to the other and said, did we make this announcement? Have we made this yet? So I think you know something that perhaps hasn't been made public. Yes.
Yeah, and then Nissan has the battery plant. Which
they sold it.
But I mean, but it's in
Smyrna, Tennessee.
Desard.
I've been in the plan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but Mercedes has also said they will do a battery pack assembly down in Alabama. So you're clearly seeing that localized.
And then we had the General Motors Brownstown.
Yeah, although that does packs, and so much of it is transitioning, I want to say, to an LG plant in Sterling Heights?
No, it's an LG plant out on the west side of the state.
Yes, and it's making cells. The Bolt with a B battery pack assembly is being done by LG. I want to say Sterling Heights, something like our Van Dyke, somewhere out there. But anyway, what I want to come back to is how do you make this jive? You said that ICE is going to be around for decades to come, especially when you hybridize it. But now you're hearing a lot of companies go, hey, two powertrains is expensive. And you know what engineers have told me? Doing a hybrid from all the electronics controls is the most complicated. More complicated than an ICE, more complicated than an EV. You put those two together, and it's really a lot of coding.
So what I think the way it drives is that people just don't know. And if they tell you they know, they probably don't. which for journalists, for researchers, is a fab. Again, I go back to this over and over. It's a fabulous time to watch this industry. It's about to turn 180 degrees, or not. And that is, John and Gary, and this is talking to companies, talking to people that in the industry, the consumers don't understand this. It's a great time to be watching this technology. And you throw on top of that the automated, connected, shared aspect of it. And we have an opportunity here to change the way we view transportation. But it doesn't happen overnight unless there's a battery breakthrough.
Yeah.
And then it might.
Okay, so... You know, Phoebe mentioned Volkswagen and the big commitment they're making to electric vehicles. And they're spending zillions of dollars to do this. And they're going to put out, you know, what, like 300 vehicles between now and 2025 or
huge.
Something.
Huge. It's insane. Yes.
Right.
Yes, their path is.
Okay. So now, arguably, part of this probably is predicated on the black eye they received because of the Dieselgate situation. Okay. And we've pretty much seen, at least in this country, that there was almost like a switch thrown in terms of pass cars in diesels. Okay, not trucks, because that's a good application, but pass cars. Where do you see diesel technology going?
I think it will struggle a lot because of the emissions. Because of the black eye, as you refer to it. And I think the opportunity lies still in the medium, mid-size, light-duty vehicles. When you look at the Suburbans and the Tahoes and those larger vehicles, it's really hard to electrify those. You can do a 48-volt mild or mild hybrid, which is good. But to get those great gas mileage or fuel economy vehicles, turn those into great fuel economy vehicles, it's going to take something kind of outside the box. Diesels offer that. They offer all the things that a driver of that segment likes with better fuel efficiency. The challenge becomes continuing to meet those emission standards. I don't think there's a huge market for them in pass cars going forward anywhere in here or maybe Germany.
Germany's actually, ratcheted up recently. It's gone up, but the thing I wonder about is, you talk about cost, you know, that a hybrid, because you have two powertrains, is more expensive. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in order to meet things like Euro 6 standards for diesels, I mean, the after-treatment systems that you're putting on these things are, I mean...
More expensive than a hybrid.
Yeah, so, you know, how does that work out?
No, I think, again, it's this incredible challenge of meeting a standard that... continues to go up, and meeting it with technology that in the old days worked, and it worked very well, but now you've got to figure out how to make the customer like either new technology or figure out how to make that old technology better, and it's going to cost money.
Okay, let's go to battery electrics. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about, the cost is coming down. You know, 10 years ago, it was $1,000 per kilowatt hour. Now it's $200 per kilowatt hour. And you got Elon Musk saying, we're going to get it down to 80. What do you think the reality is? Where do you think we really are going to settle in? Based on what you know, like you said, there could be a breakthrough out there, and that could change everything. But based on what you know right now, where do you think we're going to be with the cost per kilowatt hour?
So I think the cost, again, there's a lot of variability in those cost numbers that you hear, a lot of different ways of looking at it. But I think in a cost comparison estimate, I think parity to a gasoline engine may be 2025. But let me throw in a caveat here. That still may not be the battery that makes it. We've talked about the battery in cold weather. We've talked about recharge times. We've talked about all those other things. That's the current lithium-ion battery that we're dealing with. And that battery will probably get sort of close to being cost competitive with the passenger car in the next 5 to 10 years. Probably very close. But is it really the technology that will turn it? Will consumers say, it's the same cost, therefore I can go use that vehicle? Or will they still look at it and say, yeah, it's a great cost, but it still doesn't do the things my other car does? It does some things wonderfully, fabulous, and I think that's an important part of gasoline in terms of electric vehicles. They do some wonderful stuff, but it doesn't do the things I'm used to.
All right, Phoebe, let me ask you this. Not him.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Not the expert. That's like, throw it my way. I'm all good.
Okay, so Brett's talking about how people have this sense that, gee, this electric car won't do what my gasoline car did.
Mm-hmm. And I had some thoughts when you were saying that. Okay. Big
so,
questions.
So, yeah. So I sort of wonder, is this a generational thing, though? So let's say you're a young person who never owned a gasoline-powered car. Mm-hmm. And then you have this electric car that maybe has a range of 200 miles, right? Not 325 miles or whatever number it is that we have in our minds that is what a car should have. Are they going to think that this is in any way, shape, or form restrictive?
I think there are two answers to that question. I think if you make an age breakdown, I think you have younger people will be as technically savvy, if not more, than older. Having said that, though, that means that people, again, I constantly refer to phones because that you have your phone as much as you have your driver's license, your identification. And anyone who has a phone knows it's undependable. It's frustrating. You're constantly having battery problems. So I believe, fair or unfair, the consumer judges vehicles through their phone experience, which is highly dissatisfied. That may not be fair to all the people working in automotive, but I believe from a younger perspective, that's what you're going to have. Secondly, I also think you have a safety insecurity at a younger age now that I think older people don't have, so that people want to know they can get in their car and they can get to a safe place under every circumstance. And today, I don't believe they view electric vehicles that way. They view, I can fill up my gas tank, and that car will sit there. It could sit there for a week. I should start it. I make sure it goes. But in an emergency, they don't want to have to think about where's the charging station. And what if the grid goes out? The grid going out is very top of mind in terms of our emergencies. In the state of Michigan, we just had a situation where we had a crisis. The power went out, and people were asked to turn everything off and turn down the heat. Those experiences, I think, consciously or unconsciously, change your attitude about electrification. It may not be obvious to you, but you know what? My grandfather and my great-grandfather all drove vehicles that took gas the same way I pump gas today. And I think it sets us up for an insecurity that I'm not sure the industry is prepared for. The government is mandating. I just came back from California, and every single person of every age I was talking to was trying to figure out, the issue now is people want to invest on the West Coast in electric vehicles. They simply don't know where to put their money. They don't know. Which automaker should I trust? Which vehicle is the best? Who's out front in development? So I think there's a big consumer audience there, but they're on hold. So we see that in the sales numbers. They're tiny. I think that may be tiny because people simply don't feel confident about which direction to go. And that's coupled with, like I said, I do believe there's an insecurity that really isn't being discussed in the industry.
That's a great point. And, you know, think about it. Right now, there are 12 electric vehicle models, three of which are Teslas, by the way. And in about 3 to 4 years, there's going to be anywhere from 80 to 120 battery electric vehicles in showrooms, if we believe what the OEMs say. Mm-hmm. So if you're saying that there's consumer, you know, confusion, especially in California right now, wait until they get flooded and they're not going to even know what to do then.
And Californians actually they're consuming information as fast as they get it. I mean, they're working people, they're accountants, they're lawyers, they're grad students, whatever, and they're reading, but they can't figure it out. There is no perceived leader today. I think you could argue Toyota is out front, Honda's out front, and Volkswagen are very strong globally. But I just don't think any of them have broken through the noise. Would you disagree?
Those are great points, and it's interesting as you say that. Part of the ongoing challenge is as they get more familiar, the technology is going to keep ratcheting up. And do I buy this technology or wait for the next? Or when I do buy this technology, and 3 years from now, it's outdated because this other stuff, you know, the auto industry hasn't had that problem for a long time. We've had very slow cycle turnover, very new technology, very slow technology introduction. But what you describe is the cell phone phenomenon.
Right, and people, and even in the newsroom, someone was very upset with their vehicle, and I'll not mention what the brand was, and they're having huge problems. And I said, you know what, you have a phone, you're used to turnover. You know, you have your iPhone 4 and 5 and 6 and 10. And she said, you know what, I'm not dropping $27,000 or $30,000 every time I buy an iPhone. Yeah. So I'm angry, and I'm apprehensive about investing in a car right now.
Was this a normal car she has a problem with? Normal being an internal combustion engine?
This is an internal combustion engine vehicle, and this feeds her concern about changing things up. She said, I'm having problems with the engine we're familiar with.
Yeah, interesting. Hey, we got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring in that phone call from Clem.
This is Clem Zerovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. With all the abundance of natural gas in the United States, why isn't more time being spent to develop ICE engines to run on natural gas? Thank you.
Good question, Clem.
I get that one?
Yeah, you get that.
Yeah, Clem, that is a really, it's an interesting point. And certainly there are other parts of the world. I know Italy, northern Italy, I believe, specifically, has a very strong natural gas.
Propane.
They also have natural gas. That
do they?
Yes,
okay.
They had been doing some. It's not trendy. It's not cool. It's hard to store in a tank. Those are reasons why you don't see it being pushed. Some of the other things, when you start to look at emissions, it has some problems with CO2 emissions. But generally, it offers some interesting opportunity for larger vehicles, for some past cars. But right now, there is so much focus on electrification, so much interest in that. And for the previous administration, almost a requirement to go down that path. Other technologies, I think, have been pushed aside more.
Yeah, let me build on what you just said there. The biggest holdback for natural gas or propane, and propane is actually easier to do. You can store it at lower pressure. The gas tanks are horrifically expensive. They're as expensive, if not more, than batteries for electric cars. And the fuel lines have got to be able to stand up to all the crash standards.
Yes.
Front impact, rear impact, side impact, rollover. So you got to build the lines like the Rock of Gibraltar. So even though the modifications to the engine are minimal and cheap to do, the tank, and it's got to be a cylindrical tank, they eat up so much luggage space in the trunk that is the big thing. I've said this on the show in years past. Anybody out there who wants to make a fortune, figure out how to store natural gas or propane at low cost and in a way that is not some big cylindrical tank that you can package well into the car, you'll be able to buy your own island. Because propane especially is significantly cheaper than gasoline, even at today's prices. Mm-hmm. And while there are some emissions issues, it burns far, 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 far cleaner than gasoline does.
Diesel.
The whole issue comes down to that tank.
Well, but then there's another issue to pile on natural gas even more, is that the efficiency of natural gas versus the efficiency of gasoline is anywhere on the order of 20 to 25% less. So basically you have that big tank in your trunk. Because remember, Honda used to have the GX. And then
Pacific, on natural gas.
Right, and it was a brilliant idea because then they partnered with that company on the East Coast, and they had a, you'd have in your own garage a fueling station, which they called Phil, which is very clever.
That ran off the natural gas for your furnace.
For your furnace or your dryer or whatever, right. And so it was a brilliant idea, but the problem was that people, you know, didn't buy these things for cost and inconvenience.
Range anxiety.
I know one person that did consider buying one. He lived in San Francisco, and it gave him access to the high occupancy lanes.
Yeah.
And that was the incentive.
You could get the sticker for the diamond.
The sticker. Right. But yeah, otherwise, your points are very important. It's very costly, and it's tough to build that tank.
The other points we raised earlier, I would say because of the share rides that are happening, I would say that's rising throughout the Midwest, the East Coast, the West Coast. So whether you're doing Lyft or whether you're doing Uber or many of the other kinds of activities, I don't think people care if those are electric because it's somebody else's problem. And a lot of people are making a lot of money doing that. And there is such growth in those industries right now. I think that's where you see a strong growth market. I mean, I learned more about Camry as a Lyft driver. So if I get in and out of an electric car every single day, I become so comfortable with it. I mean, if I were selling electric cars, I'd be giving deals to people who drive Lyft and Uber. Because it is like it is your consumer introduction to a car to see if you're comfortable, and there's none of that kind of talk.
So does General Motors have
in Bolt in Maven?
Yeah, they have them in a couple of different ways. They have them in Maven, but they also have a Maven operation out in San Francisco where they're using them for ride sharing or ride hailing. They're using them for delivery at night. So they're doing some of those things. And you see, and San Francisco is the great petri dish of all of this technology.
Here's another question, getting back to the batteries. I see two mega issues with them. Number one, the energy cost to manufacture batteries for electric cars.
Yes.
Massively energy intensive. Even the Union of Concerned Scientists has said that, and I'm paraphrasing, an electric car that has roughly 240-mile range, rolls off the assembly line with a carbon footprint that's almost 70% larger than a car with an internal combustion engine. So you got that. Now, over time, the electric car is so much cleaner, it will make up and, in fact, improve on that carbon footprint. But it starts out dirty. So unless you're driving lots and lots and lots and lots of miles, it takes years to eradicate that gap. Secondly, nobody knows how to recycle these batteries. And I mean truly recycle them. I'm not talking about taking the pack out and getting a few materials. I mean full recycling. And my fear is in a decade, we start dumping millions of batteries in the landfill. And now how green are electric cars? Where do we stand with reducing the energy that goes into them in the first place and being able to recycle them at the end of their life?
So, John, both are clearly focuses and challenges. And I'll go to the second one first, end-of-life use. Clearly, we don't have that many batteries that are at end of life. We're still in startup phase for that. We're still learning. There's a lot of work being done here, an enormous amount of work being done in Europe on this. They'll take them in Europe. They're required to take them back, take them apart, and dispose of them properly. But in terms of recycling, it's still not there. It won't be there, I would argue, until the scale economies make it useful, so you can get enough batteries coming back in to actually get value out of taking them apart and turning them into something. But also, and I keep coming back to this idea that we don't really know what the true chemistry or the true makeup of a real high volume mass market battery is going to be. And until you know that, you don't know the recycling. You don't know that what that value is. But it's clearly one that in Europe where they have rules on take back, where they have to be required to take back their product, manufacturers, they're working through that. They're taking them apart. They're taking care of the pieces and the materials. But we don't know. Sorry. We don't know what we don't know. And with that development, it takes time to understand where it's going. I think it's an important concern, but I think as you get that volume and you get to understand it, it becomes more doable.
And just to be clear so people know that in Europe, they have to take back everything. It's just not batteries.
Right.
I mean, any car, any basic product that's part of their loss.
Take back the vehicle and basically recycle it, disassemble it.
So what happens to lead-acid batteries?
They get recycled.
99.9%?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Anything that's metal in a car gets recycled because there's a market demand for it. Steel, aluminum, copper, zinc, magnesium, you name it, lead. There is market demand for that. And so if you go to any of the recycling yards, what we used to call junk yards, but now it gets recycled, there are trucks leaving by the hour, jam-packed with every single kind of metal that comes out of a car. There is almost zero demand for plastic. We know how to recycle it. Thermoplastic, thermoset, we know how to recycle this stuff all day long. But the recycled plastic is more expensive than virgin plastic. So there's some, you know...
Yep.
Some cases where plastic is recycled for demonstration purposes. There's almost zero market demand. Zero of the glass in cars gets recycled because most glass is tinted. The windshields and, in some cases, the driver and front passengers are laminated. They've got radio antennas embedded into them, or they have defrosting elements embedded into, so zero glass gets recycled. Even though there's been decades and decades of research on how do we do something with this, and that's why I raised the issue of recycling batteries. It's not just a technical issue of figuring out how to do it. Will there be a market demand for those materials at the end?
Very important. The economics drive it.
Yeah.
It's been years since I did this study, but we did some recycling work before, and I think there was 400 to 500 pounds of what they called automotive shredder residue, ASR, after when you knock up the vehicle and thing.
And recycling guys call it fluff.
Yes, the fluff, but we just can't do anything with it.
Right.
Your question is with the battery. Yeah. And I believe that certainly because it's being driven in Europe, with some of the take-back regulations, that will be maybe not 99% like lead-acid batteries, but a strong, viable market. And there's also the reuse market for it. And, you know, there's some argument whether who'd want a 11, 12-year-old lithium-ion battery when you could go out and buy a new generation lithium-ion battery much cheaper. But there will be opportunities. When that battery comes out of the passenger car, it is not a bad battery.
Correct. It can be reused.
It can be reused.
But it will come to an end of life.
At some point.
And that's
all right. Let me ask a question that's more general, less in the weeds in terms of the technology of battery chemistry. And Phoebe, you may have some insight into this that we don't have. Okay, So Brett was mentioning, you know, the advancements that are being made in Europe in terms of dealing with stuff like this. And, you know, and if you think about the three domestic companies, meaning the traditional General Motors, Ford, and now FCA, why is there very little noise coming out of these companies about electric cars or even hybrid cars compared to what we're seeing
internationally?
Yeah.
So while you were talking about this, I was realizing I spoke to, I had a meeting with an Israeli businessman who does a lot of work here and has offices all over the globe. And he said he was stunned by the lack of government leadership in the United States. He felt that it set up our country to be so disadvantaged financially. And he said Japan has 10-year projects. You know, you prioritize televisions. You're going to become the best television maker. Then you become the best automotive producer. And so Japan has these priorities. Israel has priorities on technology and cybersecurity and things. And he observed that in the United States, we fight each other. We fight external forces. And our own competitive industries have very, very little government guidance, support, or basic standards. So our people are busy fighting each other, fighting the government, and begging for standardization. And so I think you have silence because I'm not sure nobody knows who the leader is in many ways. I think it is waiting for external forces to shape the market.
But, I mean, I sort of wonder, like, okay, right now the Chicago auto show is going on. Mm-hmm. And right now, all those companies are introducing new heavy-duty versions of their pickup trucks, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
And I think Sean had on the show today about the dominance of you know, the domestic market in terms of, maybe it was yesterday, you know, like that basically Toyota and Nissan, when it comes to pickup trucks in the United States, are just rounding errors, right, on F-150 sales. And so, you know, there's a lot of activity there, and obviously they're very profitable vehicles, but...
So this morning, before I came over to do the show, I talked to a big investment guy who manages $100 billion. He's based in Michigan. He has a huge investment fund. And on that point, he was simply saying, this is the only healthy economy right now.
He's in the world.
In the world. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about trucks, we're the only healthy economy and we're all trucks all the time. And so that is all people are talking about. And another study just came out in the last few days that non-Detroit automakers actually don't have credibility with consumers in trucks at all. You can do your advertising, everything else, but really it is Ford, it is GM, it is Chevy. And, excuse me.
Ram.
Yes, thank you. Oh, my God. And the Ram. But it is an amazing thing. That's what we do and do well. But the investment people are saying they're watching Europe, they're watching China, And from an auto standpoint, watching these launches, we'll see, I don't know what anyone's going to do because everyone's pulling back so dramatically. And in the near term, they said, I mean, we're asking people to really redirect their money in a big way. Usually the long-term investment people just say, hold your breath, it's going to be okay. But he was much more aggressive about that, and I think that goes to your point. Everyone's focusing on the U.S. right now. Mm-hmm. Volkswagen said, you know, if everyone wants to pull out of traditional passenger cars, we're okay with that. We will step in and we will take all those customers. But this is the market everyone's watching right now.
Yeah. Hey, look, we got to take a hold that thought, Brett. We'll come back to that. Don't forget it. We're going to take a quick commercial break right now because we got to celebrate. We have to hug. We have to welcome the companies that make this show possible.
We do.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. And this is normally the part of the show, and we haven't done this
in
a while.
For a while.
It's time for Dr. Data.
All right, so you hear about big data. This, you're going to have a set of big numbers, okay? And it has something to do with something we've talked about briefly, but we've talked about it on today's show. So, Katie, could you please bring that number? Okay, so 30.3 billion miles, 1.7 billion hours, and this occurred in 2018.
Oh, I got an idea, but I'm not going to say it first. I'm going to let Brett and Phoebe guess.
I got a guess, but it's...
I'll go first.
I do have a guess.
So I'm going to say 30.3 billion miles is how many miles electric cars drove... And they spent 1.7 billion hours charging.
Boy, that's exactly where I was going. And I'm not just riding on your coattails. If it's right, it's where I'm going.
All right, so that's what these guys are saying. Electric. It's not electric. So, Phoebe.
I have no idea.
We talked about this just briefly. We just touched on this subject. Briefly, we touched on this subject.
Give me more of a hint. Uncle. I have no idea.
All right. So, I mean, I just saw that this is, because these numbers are so big, you got to think of what country would have big numbers like
China.
Okay. So what is a subject that we talked about people doing? San Francisco area.
Rideshare?
Just go.
It's rideshare.
Okay.
How many miles and hours
Katie, bring the answer.
Rideshare?
So this is what, okay. So Didi, in their... operations last year, so they had 550 million users, 31 million drivers in 1,000 cities. People spent all that time. So apparently that number, according to the South China Morning Post, is the distance of going to Neptune and back five times.
Ride-hailing miles.
Yeah.
By the way, what they found in San Francisco is people are using more vehicles, not fewer, with ride sharing. It puts more cars on the road. People don't leave their car at home. More people are out doing stuff. It's counterintuitive. Yeah.
Well, more cars on the road at any given time.
Yes. Yes.
Fewer cars parked is what I'm guessing.
Though. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we probably don't need as many cars to move all those people around, even though there are more cars on the road at any given time.
So you're suggesting that the total car park should be reduced?
I'm not the only one to say this. Most everybody studying the issue thinks the car park is going to drop dramatically.
But what does the Center for Automotive Research say about this?
But I think the response to that is yes, but the deadhead miles of cars traveling without a rider to go get someone And just had DOE in our office a couple days ago, and some folks from there referenced some data that they think those deadhead miles may actually make it less energy efficient at some point, because you've got these cars zipping around doing all these things where they used to just be parked point to point. There's a lot of there's that concern. Yes, we've got fewer car park for the industry to sell to, but it's also a challenge, might be a challenge for environmental reasons that you never thought of.
Unless they're electric, maybe?
If they're electric, but you still got the energy usage of them.
True.
If it's
coal, maybe it's not so great.
If it's renewables, it's great.
Yeah. Okay, Carmen just told us, Phoebe, that the chat room wants to hear you talking about Tesla.
I have to say it was very... So in California, you see Tesla. That's all you see is Tesla. So here it seems exotic and different, and people in the Midwest... to the East Coast, I think you see more Tesla, but on the West Coast, it is everywhere. It's as common as any vehicle. And I do think and hear again and again that Tesla continues to transform how people feel about this new technology. And again and again, much like our president, I hear consumers say, Elon Musk is a billionaire. And you always can trust a billionaire. You can't believe how much people say that. They associate that. That's a real feeling and a true feeling. So to that extent, I think Elon Musk, even though he's got some challenges and he's behind the curve on production, he's got manufacturing things, I think people would be less forgiving if they just went to one auto plant and then they heard Elon Musk talk about some of his challenges, because there's such a gap. You can be brilliant, but you have to bring your brilliant idea to fruition. And I think the number of cars he makes per year is about, the number of F-150s they build in a week or a day. I mean, something crazy. So I think Elon Musk is, it's transforming, but, the Tesla consumer is patient. Is patient. I hear from people saying, I'm willing to wait. I'll wait till the end of time, because once I get it, and the people I know who drive Tesla vehicles are the happiest people. I mean, they feel like they're all Air Force pilots, and they talk men and women, predominantly men. They do the 0 to 60 button. I mean, it's better than Disney World, and they're just, it's the one thing everyone's talking about, though, is people will go to cocktail parties and do the autopilot home. It can get you home. And I'm waiting to see who's responsible if you get pulled over, because you're really not driving. You're in the driver's seat, but it is actually driving you all the way home. But Tesla is continuing to be the one to watch, even with his challenges. And frankly, the investment community, he gets leeway that the traditional automotive companies do not.
Well, he made money for 2 quarters in a row now. Come on. What's the problem?
It's a completely different standard.
Tesla, for those of us that have watched the industry for a long time, and from reporter side, research side, is the best thing to ever happen.
Yeah.
It has been so great, because they have shown what new ideas can do. They've also shown how doggone hard it is to really build a car. And they've pushed everybody else in the industry to think and rethink what they're doing. And they've changed the culture, whether this industry wants to believe it or not, but they've absolutely changed the culture in an industry that probably needed a culture change.
Well, I would say that Tesla has made cars sexy for the whole industry. You've always had sexy cars. You've had Corvettes. You've had things that people love. But Tesla, in a way, has made the whole industry more enticing, more intriguing. Yeah.
But so Tesla has fought for the last 10 years to try to be not known, or known as not a car manufacturer. They don't want to be part of this industry because it's not a sexy industry.
And the CEO of GM said again this week, do not think of us as a car company. See, we are a technology company.
And when Barra said that, it brought me back to this idea of when they did their financials. What did they say that they made all their money on?
Trucks.
Okay.
Except.
And then GM Financial, so.
But investors, when you go to an investment house and you say, where should I put my money? They say technology. So if you categorize your company as a tech company, you automatically change how you're viewed in investment, because everybody wants to invest in tech. People do not want to invest in cars.
I think that's going to change. So here's my 2 cents worth of where we're going with EVs. I think we're headed for a mega disaster in the 2022 to 2023 time frame. And it goes back to what I said before. There's a dozen EV models right now, 3 of which are Teslas. Take the Tesla out of it. The sales are nothing. and you know, look at the latest sales on the Jaguar I-Pace. They're nowhere. They did, I think, 220 last month. So now let's go forward, 2022, 2023. We have anywhere from 80 to 120 BEV models. I don't think the public's ready for them. Comes back to what you said, Phoebe. I'm used to putting that nozzle in and pumping gasoline. And now, oh, my God, it's cold outside. I'm going to lose half my range. I don't think the public's ready. So what I think is going to happen is we're going to throw all these cars into showrooms. They're going to be nailed to the showroom floor. Everyone's going to have to start discounting them like crazy. Now you start the death spiral with your residual values. It's going to be a disaster, and it'll be headlines everywhere. Oh, my God, this electric car thing is a disaster. Now, the industry is really good at working through disasters. It's got a 100-year history of doing it, and the industry will work its way through this problem. And ergo, I'm saying around 2027, 2028, we'll have digested this, and now we can talk about where EVs are going. But I think in the short term, it's going to be a mess.
So, yeah.
Go ahead, Brett. Yeah, no.
So one of the things that the Center for Automotive Research does is it does an annual event in Traverse City, mm-hmm. the Management Briefing Seminar. And Brett is a host of a panel. Mm-hmm. And 3 years ago, I think, you had on the powertrain panel a guy from Tesla,
Dermot O'Connell.
Yep. Right.
Dermot left. Was supposed to be on a panel a year and a half ago, but he left the day before.
Right.
So yeah.
So
left Tesla
left
the
Tesla.
Day before.
All right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I recall him saying when he and everybody else on the panel was all about internal combustion engines. Right. I mean, is that a fair?
Mm-hmm. Very much.
Description.
Very much.
Okay. And so. You remember this better than I do, but it seems to me that one of the points he made was that if you go to a car dealership, they want to sell you a car that has an engine. They don't want to sell that electric car over there.
They don't know how to.
Right. And they also said that if you look at the cars that they basically have in terms of the efficiency, it ain't so good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. if you can buy a Kia Soul EV or a Kia Soul, it's like, why would you buy the EV?
He also, I think, referred to them as appliances like toasters, but yeah.
We've heard that before.
Yes,
some
toaster Mr. Lutz.
Okay, so the thing is that I wonder about is that, do you think it's a technical issue that will keep people away from buying these cars, or is it a perception issue that's predicated on the fact that, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, you realize that Tesla has never run an ad, a single ad, for any of their cars? That Tesla basically doesn't have a public relations operation that all of us are familiar with dealing with in terms of regular mm-hmm. car companies, mm-hmm. that basically all of the communications that comes out of Tesla is like Elon blogging?
Because it doesn't need to. It's all word of mouth. That's what makes it so...
Right, and so if you look at that, how successful they've been without doing the stuff that is you know, if you want to sell, I don't know, soup, I mean, you've got to advertise, right?
Well, Ram Trucks took a pass on the Super Bowl this year, and they had the largest engagement for any automaker online. They did their direct-to-consumer ads that were so powerful. So, I mean, I think that's where people are. Speak directly to them. That's where they are today in many, many ways. For the high-end products, the luxury products, absolutely. Super high-end stuff. No?
I'm still holding on to what you said. I got to come
back. Yeah, yeah.
Remember that Tesla has a unique product, has a unique technology, but more than anything, what does Tesla have?
Elon.
He is a god to these people.
Right.
For a lot of good reasons. He's done some wonderful things and some strange things. And I thought we were going to have whiskey and maybe a joint for the, but no. he is certainly, people, I believe, buy Teslas because they like electric vehicles, because they do wonderful things for them. But equally, and maybe even more so, they buy them because there's a visionary leading them.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And no other company has that. Therefore, those companies need to...
When I went to the gallery at Somerset Mall in Troy, and there were Michigan people there looking at Teslas because they're
this
shown
is
in a gallery.
Mall for those who
high
are
end mall, luxury yeah. mall, and of course Tesla isn't a dealer. It has a gallery in the mall next to Tiffany's and Macy's. And I talked to people in this gallery, and they said they took trips to California to drive past Tesla to figure out where Elon Musk might eat. They took their family on trips because he is exactly what you said, as much an attraction and a mystery and a visionary. I mean, he is a Thomas Edison of our time. That is how he is viewed.
I'll say this. I am knocked out by Tesla's product. I love their vehicles. I didn't get that, and I didn't become this way until I was able to, a friend of mine lent me his Tesla for a weekend. You don't get it. You don't really understand what Tesla is about, driving it for 20 minutes, driving it for 40 minutes. You got to live with it a bit. So I love the product. I respect Elon in many ways. I'm not an Elon, you know, acolyte whatsoever. But Tesla's product is super impressive. Mm-hmm. So it's the two. It's him being the visionary, but the product is kick-ass. You know, so I think the Chevrolet Bolt with a B is a very good electric car. It's sales-proof. The Nissan Leaf is a very competent electric car. They practically can't give them away. Jaguar came out with this gorgeous-looking I-Pace. Sales are meh, whatever. So it's... There is the Elon factor, but I'm telling you, there's something about those Tesla cars that are far, far, far superior to the other electric cars out there.
So back to your, I've been holding off on this,
yeah,
I apologize.
Okay. Yeah.
Back to your vision for 2022, 2023. Some nights I think, exactly. But remember, when we see the numbers of investment dollars going into this and models, so much of that is targeted for the Chinese market. We won't probably see all of those vehicles here. There's and they have, back to Phoebe's point earlier about leadership, about government leadership, they have kind of a top-down leadership there, right? They can tell the people what
kinda
to buy.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Europe has kind of a bottom-up where there's a pull for some of these technologies. They're still going to struggle with electric vehicles, but there's a social responsibility there. So China has a very strong industrial policy. Europe has a social policy with an industrial policy in some of the countries. The U.S. has no real policy in that. So when you talk about electric vehicles in the U.S., it scares me a lot. But when you start to take in the broader picture of China, and that may not work there, Europe.
I completely agree with you. What I was talking about, the fiasco, is strictly talking about the U.S. market.
But I don't think we'll have that. We may, but I don't think we'll have that many vehicles or that many models in this market.
Well, I went through on a Google search, and I searched what every automaker has announced they're going to do.
For this market?
That's where I got the numbers from.
For this market?
For this market, yes.
All right, so the question becomes, to your point, Brett, that if these vehicles are largely being developed Europe and in for China, and then to your point, Phoebe, about how you've heard from these people, you know, asking about what the U.S. is doing in terms of leadership, where does that put the U.S. auto industry 10 years from now?
I think it's a really fascinating question. There's some that are going to argue that it's going to be the profitable market for the next decade because people will buy the products they want to buy. They'll pay for those products, and you'll get top dollar for top dollar products, the full-size pickups, the SUVs, the large CUVs. It could be a very profitable market compared to other markets. You've already mentioned that other markets tend to be kind of trending down in ways right now. But where do we stand as a technology leader at the end of that? Sure, we've potentially made money, and others participating in the market will make money. But has all of the research, all of the development, all of the engineering been lost overseas? And I've heard it referred to as a technology island or a technology backwater. And I'm not sure which we become.
I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that at all. Is General Motors investing any less in electrification than other automakers? Is Ford?
But a lot of that is focused on the Chinese market. Now,
they're still doing the research anyway. They're still getting the capabilities.
But as they grow the market, they grow the technologies, they grow the strengths in those markets, they'll build a greater...
Here's where I see the issue, is especially in the supplier community.
Yes.
Because you're going to make inverters, you're going to make electric motors, you're going to make chargers, you're going to make fill-in-the-blank, everything that's needed for electric cars. And you're a Bosch, a Magna, a Continental, whatever, and you go, man, I got to invest in this stuff. where am I going to invest it? Well, they're going to sell them in China. I'm putting my plant in China. And so the critical mass gets built in China to a somewhat lesser degree in Europe. And not at all or very little in the United States. So I don't think we're going to lose the technical capability, but we're not going to have the manufacturing base.
So much of our industry's technical capability now is in the supply base.
Right.
And that's, you just said we're going to lose it. Go name the top five U.S.-based powertrain companies, suppliers. It's hard to do.
BorgWarner. Dana.
American Axle. I mean, there's a number of them.
But there's not like it used to be.
Well, there's not anything like there used to be.
But there's a lot of the companies that do great business here are German, are right. French, are Chinese, are growing Japanese. Right. That research, to me, tends to be dragged back to the main offices. We see it right now with companies we deal with. The concern is how much just application engineering will we do here, or will we be able to grow our real research if this market doesn't pull that technology?
See, I sort of get the sense that the car company, maybe you know this in terms of real numbers instead of my opinion on this. But it seems to me that, you know, like in the case of General Motors, I would argue perhaps that they're spending more doing research on autonomous vehicles than they are on electrification. Mm-hmm. In that this seems to be even, you know, like you know, it's just like the sexy thing, besides Teslas, is automated driving, right? I mean, everybody wants to do that. And you know, and we hear Ford is...
Which everyone calls robot cars, right? That's the thing out in the world. They never use autonomous. It's a robot car.
Okay, so robot... Weird. So yeah. So
I hate that term.
So it seems to me that becomes where the focus is here, and not so much things like powertrain, because, you know, powertrain's sort of pedestrian, right? I mean, it's just like, yeah, they'll... Is that true, or am I just...
No, I think they definitely, I mean, it's definitely moths to the flame. I mean, absolutely. And the other is, what I wonder about going back to national leadership, which is lacking on a bipartisan level, mm-hmm. and that is, I think what the foreign researchers do well is patents, right? So you can develop and license, if you have the patents, everybody has to pay you for them, and it's clean. And so you have a lot of researchers in other countries. They come here to be educated. It's fantastic. But, you know, we have the best teachers. We have the best technology, but we're not patenting things. We're not holding on to that and generating revenue. It's like, you know, you make Q-tips. If you invented Q-tips, you get a portion of every Q-tip that sells in the world. I mean, we're not, right? We're not, but we don't think of that here. And I think that's not how we're thinking.
So to back that up, the U.S. DOE labs are leaders, global leaders, in battery technology development. Mm-hmm. But we don't commercialize.
Right.
The technology is commercialized elsewhere, and that's a huge challenge for us. We've never.
Because
last 50 years, we have not been great at commercializing.
It's easy to explain. We have a corporate financial system that's based on quarterly reporting. These kinds of investments that are needed for commercializing that technology have longer time frames to them. American management, American investors will not invest for the long term, or few will. Some will, but you need the Elon Musks and that who have got money bags all around them.
And Amazon. Those are the three best examples, right?
There are a few examples, but, you know, when you look at so much that this country has lost from a manufacturing standpoint, it's like outsourcing. Go to the cheapest place. So it's not that we don't have the technical capability. We don't have the financial systems that support being able to go for the long term. Hey, look, we're getting right down to this. This time has flown past. A number of people have written in with questions. We ought to ask the questions of you guys and get these answers. So Sherman Farm says, in 1980, AT&T asked McKinsey to forecast cell phone users in the year 2000.
Yes.
McKinsey said there would be 900,000 people using it. In point of fact, he says it was 109 million. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, Brett, what do you think will be the history of electric vehicle adoption?
So I've seen that data, and Steve Sherman, from a friend of mine, uses that data all the time, and it is really important data. It is. It's really scary sometimes. And I will argue that that inflection point may happen in this industry.
Right.
But I think it's going to take a battery that we haven't seen yet. And when we get that battery, It may happen
quickly. Like that.
And that's the difference, I guess, between a visionary and someone with a dartboard. It's hard to figure out when that'll happen. But his numbers are really important to remember.
Yeah. But I would actually completely disagree with you.
Huh? Good.
100% completely. And I'll tell you why. Because one's putting in your pocket. It's a lifestyle device, right? And, well, it stores your photos. You call your mother. You're using it as a video camera and a still camera. And, I mean, I just think...
I understand, but when that better product is out there, people will use it.
I don't think you can't, but it's the phone is used for so many different things. Mm-hmm. Your car you can use to get between point A and B, and as your office between points A and B.
And to call your mom.
It's all the activity while you're in the vehicle. And so therefore I think it's inherently limiting and inherently less profitable. And the phone, it's everything you can imagine in the bathroom. You hear people in the bathroom on the telephone, and it is unbelievable, right? So they use this device 24 hours a day. Couples, they keep them under their pillows when the children are out. I mean, it is advertisers saying it's how you track your children around the clock. I just don't think you can compare those numbers. I absolutely don't think.
The comparison I like to use is if you go back to 1903, there were barely any cars. Mm-hmm. If you go to 1913... there's barely any horses in major cities. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took a decade to flip like that. They will go to a better one. I think that's a better analogy for autonomous ride sharing than it is for electrification. But
I wonder where those horses went.
They grew old.
They went to the glue factory.
Yes.
Okay, Gary, this one's for you. Barry Rector from Indy says, where do you think the SARS is going to end up for 2019?
16.8.
That's what I think. It
does. I think it's going to be, we're at a flat line period at this point, a little down, but nothing scary.
Number?
16.799.
Ooh.
Right? Can't go over?
Any guesses?
I think it's lower. I think the numbers in 2018 were higher than expected.
Yeah, sales actually went up.
Right. I think the numbers were surprisingly high, and therefore I think we'll feel a backlash. Yeah. I think it'll drop.
Price is right. Come on.
No, lower. I don't want to lower.
You know, most of the analysts are with Phoebe, but I'm with Gary. 16.8 is what I'm going to say.
We're right.
Yeah.
It's always happened.
Definitely
been.
Lower.
Okay.
Except when we're wrong.
Brett S. from Madison, Wisconsin says...
Good name.
GM's canceling the Voltec powertrain that's in the Volt with a V as in Victor. It seems to have abandoned, he says, GM has abandoned hybrids and plug-ins in favor of EVs. Yep. Ford and FCA seem to be sticking with electrified ICEs. What do you think's the better strategy?
I wish I knew. It is clear that General Motors has made the point, and they've made it to me in other places, that having two powertrains is the long-term bad decision. The question is, what is the mid, or how long out, how far out is the long term? And I think there's a lot of disagreement on that. I think it's limited resources. It takes a lot of money to develop these. If you're going to develop something, go down one path, have partners on the other paths. So I think, Brett, I think the reality is it's not an illogical decision that GM's made. It's one that kind of assumes they have an answer already, and they may, but I think it's a bit risky.
Say, who's been following all these heavy-duty trucks that have been announced?
All of us.
Ford.
Okay, then I'm throwing this to you, Phoebe. Ray Mitrowitz says, all these heavy-duty trucks have just been revealed. I mean, boom, they have all come out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which one seems the most notable to you? Ram, GM, or Ford?
There's absolutely no question that Ram is eroding market share with Silverado right now. Ford is holding. Ford will.
Well, that's light duty.
The heavy duties.
We should talk light duty too.
I'm sorry. I was thinking the other because I just came out of a market share analysis. on that question, I would lean toward Ford. And that would be super duty because you've got the loyalty you're building on it, and it's a new product. Ford Light is holding the numbers, and there's really nothing new there. So when Ford has a new product, people will gravitate. If you have to choose between the three, and you can go with the trusted and the oldest, most established, I believe. So I think Ford, no question. That's what I'm hearing on that. But the other is very different.
On the light truck, Ram is coming on like a monster, right?
I think it's going for number two in a big way. And watching the incentive play right now is really quite astonishing. So GM and FCA are really playing hard on cash on the hood. That's all I've heard for the last 2 weeks, cash on the hood. So Ford's holding its market. But I would say that was our top story, I think, over the last week, was the Super Duty and heavy interest in that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on the Ford on the heavy duty, simply because their range is so much bigger.
Right.
You know, if you got the 350, the 450, the 550, the 650, the 750.
And trusted and loyal.
And Chevy and Ram just don't have that breadth of, choice out there.
Yep.
Okay, Chris is, he says, why can't BMW, Mercedes, Audi just make a 3 Series C-Class or A4 EV? They've converted their ICE cars to EVs before. He doesn't understand the restraints. Why can't they make small electric cars?
I'm sure I understand.
Well, I guess what he's asking is, Audi's doing the e-tron, BMW's doing the iNEXT, Mercedes is doing the EQ, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So instead of smaller cars.
I'd watch Audi, because Audi's working with Volkswagen money, and Volkswagen's all in. So that's going to be the one to watch on that. But I would wonder about profit margin, because the volume just isn't there for those, right?
So when you're building, historically we've looked at it and said, well, we'll build a car and build multiple powertrains for it. Mm-hmm. That was really inefficient for the vehicle, for the platform itself, for the product, for the driving. So you've got to figure out, to Phoebe's point, where can I make some profit off this? You're going to go to a larger luxury end where people will pay for it, and build an unique electric platform, and then take the MEB platform at Volkswagen, and it'll be a smaller vehicle.
But I think that BMW has announced that they're package protecting all of their vehicles being developed from now going forward to make electric versions of them. Okay. I mean, they've made that statement.
Where there seems to be unique confidence for the electric is trucks, actually. People feel so confident with their pickups that and the profit margin is so enormous, I think you will see more adoption there, and I think the companies will feel comfortable moving toward that. Mm-hmm. Because I think you do have the profit built in.
But it's a duty cycle that is so different than an electric battery vehicle likes. It's a great opportunity for some work truck kind of things, but to put a battery that big or into that vehicle that is big enough to tow the things you need to tow.
Yes.
Is going to take a lot of...
And you need that battery breakthrough.
Battery breakthrough. Yeah. That's going to happen.
The other thing I would come back to is, right now, nobody can make a profit on an electric car that's priced under $50,000. Yep. You just can't do it. So why would you come out with this little car to lose money on? They're not in the business of losing money. So they're going to come out with these SUV-sized things that are going to be priced expensively. Mm-hmm. And at least you're not going to lose your shirt on coming out with it.
And, John, that's been an interesting switch that I think Tesla led over the years. This was initially an econo car kind of discussion. We're going to make these small, very efficient vehicles. Oh, but not a lot of people want to buy those, and we lose a lot of money on them. Why don't we try going way up market? Because Tesla seems to be getting away with that. And the realization was, if we're going to get this expensive technology, let's find people that want to pay for it. And people that are looking for a better fuel economy don't want to pay for it when they can get a 45-mile-per-gallon Yaris or something.
That's right. Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap it up. This has been a terrific show. Brad, thanks so much for coming on, just sharing all your knowledge. Phoebe, awesome. Awesome having you on the show. And Gary, this is fun. Let's do it again next week.
Try that.
Okay, real good. And as always, thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.
You know, I was looking.
We're still live.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, the show's over, but we're still live.
Don't say what you really think about him.
Yeah.
I'm used to it.
So, you know, the thing about General Motors and the Volt and the Voltec, mm-hmm. and that, you know, and so I looked. Okay. So combining sales of the Volt and the Bolt last year, 36,000 units.
Yeah.
Look at the Toyota Prius, which was down nearly 20%, 87.5. So, gee, I wonder why they might not be all that interested in making hybrid vehicles. And this gets back to your point. Toyota's in it for the long run.
Toyota believes in it, and so they'll sell them.
And
it has to do with if you can rebate. This whole discussion will be driven by government rebates, whether they exist or don't. So if someone makes a determination that, you know, it's a whether you believe in a climate change impact or whatever, I think that's what will drive this. That's what China's doing. I think that's what California will end up. I think that's what will happen.
See, I just wonder, you know, like that Green New Deal that's now being floated. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that is going to end up having an effect on whether we have more electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles or
it could.
Or, you know, 48-volt system, whatever have you. I mean, it just seems that there seems to be, you know, almost like this global momentum that is beginning that people are saying, holy crap, you know, Australia is on fire and you know, and we're
freezing.
40, ice caps 40, are melting.
And we're 40 below in the ice, you know, I mean.
This week and next week, we're tanning outside.
So there seems to be like, an increasing number of people are saying something's going on and we got to do something about it.
Back to China clearly has a top-down thing. In Europe, when you go over there, and I go over there skiing, when you ride a chairlift in Europe, all they want to talk about is how their ski seasons are shorter, how they're going to make a difference, and they're going to change it. That's a social change. In the U.S.,
not so. We're not there.
Well, once it becomes, I think, a business argument, going to your point, if it becomes mm-hmm. about the ski lodge, if it becomes about profit margins for GM, Ford, FCA, once it becomes a business argument, not just do you like this car or that car, I think that's where the whole thing pivots for sure.
See, I still like the idea of cap and trade. And, you know, it's interesting. Cap and trade started in this country amongst coal-fired utilities to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions, SO2. And from 1990 to the year 2000, in this country, we reduced SO2 emissions, I can't remember the exact amount, 80-90%. And at first, the utilities were completely against this idea of cap and trade. But once they got into it, they came to love it because it was not this diktat that said, thou shalt put all these scrubbers and everything on, and you're going to have to hit these targets. It was a way using free market principles of saying, we're going to give everybody these credits, and you have to turn them in to meet your SO2 emission level. And if you spent more or had ways of reducing your SO2 emission credits, you could sell them to utilities that were not making that investment, at least not that snapshot in time. And because it was dragged out over a decade and it was very predictable and market-based, we achieved an astonishing reduction, and the utilities all loved it. And it worked so well that when there was the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, you know, the first meeting globally to reduce global warming, reduce CO2, the U.S. Senate set Republican-dominated Republican Senate set three stipulations. And if you'll remember, Bill Clinton sent Al Gore to Tokyo to negotiate on the part of the United States. So the Senate said,
where Al Gore found his true calling.
His true calling, he did. But number one was, everybody's got to be in on the agreement. We, the United States, are not going to sign in if China and India and Brazil and others are going to sit it out. So everybody's got to be in. Number two is, whatever we agree to cannot harm the economy of the United States. And number three, and this is the Republicans dictating it, whatever mechanism gets put in place has to be a cap and trade system. because it's based on free market principles. And somehow or other, that's all gotten convoluted to the point today Republicans are dead set against cap and trade, and it's the Democrats who are in favor of it. But here's my wrinkle, where I think you change everybody in this country differently. If we allow utilities to buy and sell credits for SO2, and now let's say we take it to where it's CO2, don't limit it to corporations and utilities. Let individual citizens reduce their carbon footprint and sell their credits on the open market. Because I believe if people learned that they could get money by getting a high-efficiency furnace or buying a more fuel-efficient or possibly even electric car or whatever it happens to be, and if there's a mechanism for capturing, yes, we can validate you reduced your carbon footprint X, here's your credit, now go out and sell it on the open market, I think you'd flip this country like that. So there's my two cents.
That's good. That's... Years in the thinking.
Yeah. You, the public, you know, look, all the polls show, I think 60% of the American public now believes that global warming is human caused and that it's a problem. But that still means 40% don't believe it at all. I think you flip those 40% by saying, oh, yeah, well, here's how you can make money by reducing your carbon footprint.
But, John, even those 60% that believe it, it's a logical, reasonable thing, are not making decisions to change it. A small portion of them are.
Right. Well, look, we're all in favor of improving the environment.
As long as you three do it for me.
But how? And if it's a more expensive solution, look, I'm living paycheck to paycheck, a lot of people will tell you. And so I want to help, but how do I do it and can I afford it?
Or the reason they're living paycheck to paycheck is they're buying really expensive things outside of their financial window. And one of them is a car because they love that big truck. The leases on a lot of luxury. What is the luxury lease rate? It's really high, and it's because the people are paying month to month. They're getting it. They want that luxury car.
Well, I would argue the real problem is that incomes have flatlined for the average household for over 20 years now. 25 years. They absolutely flatlined. This gets us into a whole other argument. You know, is
I thought I heard the other night that all incomes are going up, but
no, incomes are going up. Look, you know, here's the example I like to use. When I got out of high school, I got a job at the Ford Rouge plant. If you inflation adjust what I got paid back then to today's dollars, I was making $43 an hour. That didn't include any benefits. $43 an hour. You tell me what kid's coming out of high school with no skills whatsoever and landing a job that pays that today. Mm-hmm. Nobody. So that shows you the middle class income has absolutely deteriorated. But another issue is, and this gets into monetary policy, the dollar. You know, we're deficit spending. We're printing money to make up for that deficit. We're driving down the value of the dollar. You know, in the year 2000, you could buy gold for about $270 an ounce. Today, it's $1,270 an ounce. And it just shows how much our dollar has eroded. If not for that, middle-income households would be doing a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. But now we're getting
I'm thinking all these different things you're doing. I mean, every time you say something, I'm thinking of responses to all these different things I've got. Because truly, when you have states that support these ideas, you have full adoption. I mean, it's tiny little examples, but you have states that say, or whole communities that say, you're not going to be able to use plastic bags. We're going to ban straws. And those are tiny. They're tiny examples, but they're really not because you're changing how you're living and what you're doing and your habits. And so I think, you know, from a car standpoint, when you say, well, people modify their ways, people do go back and say, if I do it, like, is anybody else doing this? You know, do you recycle because you can sell stuff or because really we have limited landfill? It doesn't matter what your politics are. It's land is limited, you know? And at the end of the day, I just think there has to be a financial argument that, you know, not do you make money recycling in Michigan, but you might say, you know what? Tourism is the top industry in the state of California, and it's clean, and they make so much money. And Michigan could be that way, but we don't look at it that way, right? We don't look at So I think there are things to change habits that all make money, but we're not really hearing that from leadership.
Takes leadership. That's right? The only thing that's going to change is somebody. Excuse me, I've got a cough here. Somebody's got to point the direction and say, here's how you can participate.
We can't even agree on the simple things in life in this country. There is.
Or like potholes, right? That's a big issue. You could argue that Gretchen Whitmer won because that every voter said, I voted for fix the damn roads.
She better fix them because I got.
She better fix them. And then this week we get an alert on this is how much money it's going to cost. And I'm thinking, I mean, you probably know a dozen people who've paid between $400 and $800 on pothole repairs, individuals.
Because they bent a rim or blew out a tire.
Right, and it's unbelievable. But we won't pay because it's going to cost the state a lot of money, but the individuals are paying. And companies, I mean, I had a meeting involving some GM folks. So many people were absent from cars being broken from potholes. And so meetings don't go as planned. I mean, that's sort of ironic in many different ways. But it goes to that point, you know? I don't know.
It's always sort of struck me that the reason why big vehicles are so popular in this part of the world is because...
Make it through potholes.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Hey, Carmen sent a message here. Thank the chatters. This is the most active chat room we've ever had.
Oh, that's very cool.
So that's pretty good.
Hopefully there were positive chatters and not negative chatters.
You got to take them both. You know, not everybody's here to agree with us.
I want a 49-51 kind of thing at least.
It's probably even,
no,
Stephen.
And it's a great topic. It really is. And I think Gary pointed out we didn't talk a lot about automated connected and that's effect on powertrain. I have a group of powertrain suppliers that I've worked with for 5 years. Gary was part of a group discussion a couple weeks ago with several of them. We asked them, okay, for next year, 2019 research, what should we focus on? And these are the companies that you all know as the powertrain companies, the biggest and the best in the world. And the number one response back for where to focus research is connected automated technologies and its impact on vehicle propulsion systems.
You just violated the NDA.
No, this was not.
I'm calling Carla.
Chatham House rules?
No, it wasn't.
Well, maybe you did violate.
The meeting was, but the survey wasn't.
Oh.
There. But, yeah, so it is a huge issue. And each of these companies, Delphi Aptiv, others are going through this split where they're old technology, new technology. You talked about being known as a technology company. Powertrain is... At least the powertrain we know is an old technology. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's
It's funny. I was doing a little bit of research, and all of internal combustion engine technology is based on discoveries from the 19th century. You know, if you look at Venturi, if you look at, you know, Otto, if you look at spark plugs and, you know, carburetors and all that stuff, was invented in the 19th century.
And it took 100 years to refine it to
right.
The point.
It's,
think
and
about
that's
that.
What people don't want to let go. That's
but also think about that with batteries. It's a and we've been
batteries are just as old.
But lithium ion really 1990 kind of where it started.
Lithium ion,
where
right.
It started.
But you know, if you look at all the terminology, watt, ampere,
are those same?
You know, it all comes from the 19th century. In fact, some of it from the 18th century.
So it's hard to beat good old technology.
So what do we have right here today that we don't see the value of that 100 years from now they're going to go, you know, this comes from 2019.
What a brilliant...
Way back then, those people knew what they were doing.
The Tesla Boring Company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's that boring technology. It's going to change the world, right?
Here's the thing.
It'll just be Facebook. That's it.
Oh. Maybe you lived in California, right?
20 years, yeah. 20 years. Just moved back.
Would you get in a boring hole company in a state known for its earthquakes?
No.
I would be terrified to get in a tunnel expecting the earthquake to hit.
That moment.
That
I mean,
moment.
You just even have tremor. I mean, it's really scary,
But at least they don't have to worry about burying
ground,
me.
Right?
No.
Isn't there, there's no underground in San Francisco?
What was, Gary, I didn't hear your question. What was it? What was your question?
I thought BART was part of
BART's
it was
underground.
Yeah.
Where is BART underground?
And I think BART even goes across or under the
downtown it is.
Where?
I've been on several. I've been on
underground. BART.
It's below street level.
It's below street level, but usually it's not like it's a long stretch. It might be under a bridge, or it might be like very tiny pieces. I don't know.
But it's under like
long.
A building. It's not like in a ditch.
There are points when I've ridden it where it's been dark walled for 5
really?
Minutes.
Really?
Yeah. I haven't ridden it a lot, but the ones that are coming from the south, coming
from the
into
south
town.
Bay?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
This actually happened a couple of weeks ago. We never talked about this, but this is germane to the subject we're having. So, as I say, this was a couple of weeks ago. Colorado auto dealers Monday sued the state over its decision to adopt California's low-emission vehicle standards, arguing the process was rife with errors, blah, 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 blah. Quote, the suit aims to protect Colorado's consumers and businesses from the huge costs and negative consequences of having the California rule. So,
Peter?
So, Colorado, right?
Well, remember, Colorado is a very different, diverse group of people.
Hillary won Colorado, so,
yeah, but there's
Here's an untapped fund no one's talking about. So you have all this marijuana stuff that's being approved all over America. And you know that, and so Colorado, in Nevada, they actually can't keep things in stock. I mean, I was dealing with a publisher up there in Las Vegas, and he said they're sold out all the time.
Of
weed. In Colorado, I mean, the sales are crazy, right? You have people switching from alcohol. You have older people. I mean, I had a client who started a delivery business, and their primary constituency was people over 80. It was enormous because there are no side effects, right, like traditional prescription drugs. But having said that, where are those taxes? So when we did our analysis on taxes in Michigan on this product, you know, in the grand scheme, very modest. That is an unharnessed opportunity. People will pay anything to get the product. What should you be using it for? Whether it's doing battery research, whether it's fixing your roads, it is this huge pot of money that other states are saying, let's earmark it.
Yeah,
pot of money. but no, I mean, it is
potholes.
It is a rep, right?
Pot for
actually,
pot. So well, that, pot that, for that, potholes.
That's actually something some elected official, because it sounds silly, but no one will ever argue if you have some. It's like in California, cities would have huge hotel taxes, huge. Like, you'd come to this town and we'd charge you $40 a night in taxes because we knew you were coming anyway because it was the nicest town and there were only 3 hotels. And whatever. And so here we don't think like that. We don't think tax the outsiders.
It's going to happen.
You think so?
Yes, I do.
So
yes,
Tuesday.
The potholes is brilliant,
Tuesday night, State of the State. Gretchen Whitmer probably watches this show, and she's
gonna put it right in. Yeah.
No, sincerely, don't you think that's like an untapped opportunity? Is it just me?
No. You're absolutely right.
I'm sure there are lots of people fighting over where to tap it to.
Yeah, I mean, when you go to Silicon Valley, the biggest use in social situations, San Francisco and Silicon Valley, in my experience, is it's all marijuana. All marijuana, yeah. Marijuana. Why? Because people are so concerned about calories in alcohol. That is why, they'll tell you. They all want to look beautiful in their suits, men predominantly. No.
They don't.
The munchy thing is a disconnect. I don't know. But it is striking to me the amount of use for weed.
I believe that'll happen in Michigan. It's very early on. Take a look. The marijuana legalization ballot initiative, more people voted for that than voted for governor. Yeah. In fact, that voted for every other thing on the ballot except
I love that.
Making it easier to vote. Proposition 3 actually got the most votes at all, which I was very proud to see.
So in our news network, no matter what the story is, whether it's a sports story, a politics story, a natural disaster, if there's a story on weed, it usually shatters the analytics. It is the interest level is insatiable.
Gary,
it's all
we gotta
ages.
Talk about weed on the show, man.
so
it's crazy. I mean, it is, and it's not an age. It's not a young thing. That's what's so striking.
So back to the point. I thought you had promised me whiskey and weed here.
I think he's waiting for Elon. Isn't that an Elon Musk moment? That's exactly
giant
what that
blunt.
Is. It's the sign of your brilliance and your billionaire status.
But I've been trying. This is okay. Sometimes I don't think straight. Maybe that's the weed. But
sometimes,
often, Volkswagen. So we have this conference in Traverse City every year, and for the last 6 or 7 years, I'm now off that beat good news, bad news. But I've been part of sponsorship and part of creating the event and creating planning. And I kept saying to people, I said, you know, IHS has cigar night, cigar and whiskey night, where they have after hours.
Up there.
Yes.
Up there. And I said, you know, at some point, we're going to need to sponsor a market ship for ganja night. And I asked Volkswagen, who were good friends, would you be interested? They said, you know, we got enough emissions issues right now.
that's right.
But it's getting closer to that ganja night.
Well, when people start seeing, like I said, when you're in the, and I'm talking wildly successful, not crazy people, not silver spooners, but people who've made their money, they're very successful, they're very serious, but that was shocking to me, frankly, that was so mainstream. My daughter teases me all the time because she thinks I'm so dated on this sort of, because that's not my thing. And But every single person I know in multiple states of every age, and it's an investment issue, and it's a revenue stream for research, and I just, we'll see.
Like I said, I'd say it's early days. Once, especially the conservatives that we have in the Republican Senate and House in the state of Michigan recognize that their districts can make a lot more money.
Huge money.
They're going to flip. They will flip on this.
It's just crazy.
And they'll start taxing it and say, yes, we want dispensaries in our district.
So, again, this is back to me. I'm not a proponent or an opponent, right. But I see an opportunity.
But that's new roads. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
Volkswagen.
Schools
Look, money,
and roads.
Money always talks, and that's what's going to drive the change, I believe.
Yeah.
Wasn't the lottery supposed to fund the schools? And
it did.
And, we're and still does.
The 48th.
But here's
worst
the bait and switch.
District.
So we legalized the state lottery for half the money to go to schools, which it still does to this day. And then the legislature went, oh, good. Now we can take an equal amount of money out of the school budget. And so instead of increasing our spend on education, it made no difference whatsoever.
Therein lies the problem.
In fact, I'll give you another example.
See, Colorado has a no-touch policy. I mean, the money is earmarked, and it's earmarked.
That would be great.
It's earmarked for?
Education.
Yeah. Is it good?
Yeah, Colorado. I mean, Colorado, it's been a windfall.
But see, earmarking it and saying all this pot money can only go to education is not good enough if the legislature can then, out of the general fund, pull
Divert.
An equal amount of Divert. Money out.
See,
that's
I'm a special
how it projects work.
I'm about the roads first. I mean, because if you have good roads, you recruit business. I mean, nobody is connecting the dots. If you have amazing roads, companies want to go there.
True.
If you've got great schools, it's all about business, jobs, investment.
But here's the other complication in Michigan. We have a 6% sales tax on gasoline, none of which goes to the roads, almost all of which goes to schools. So one of the talks right now, and I think Gretchen Whitmer might talk about this in her State of the State, is let's devote all that money to fixing the roads. And I'm reading the tea leaves here. I think because trying to raise the gasoline tax is like the third rail. It's the third rail of politics, right? It's so hard to do. I think what Gretchen is saying is, look, I can get this 6% sales tax, put it into fixing the potholes, and she thinks, this is me
and
saying, that it's going to be easier to raise taxes to fund schools than it is going to be to raise taxes to fix the roads.
Yes.
That's how I'm reading it. We'll see if it plays out that way.
She has to fix those roads, though.
Oh, yeah. It's got to be done. Got to be done. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, Michigan had the best roads in the nation. No exaggeration.
What happened?
We also hired the best civil engineers out of the best civil engineering schools. And then what happened is the first oil crisis in 1973, and it really hit the state hard. We had massive budget cuts. And so what we did was we cut all our maintenance of roads. We kept on building roads and bridges, but we cut the maintenance. And another thing that we did in the late 60s is we allowed studded snow tires on cars. And they were legal for about 4 or 5 years.
I can still remember hearing them go down the road.
Oh, man, they were awesome. They were awesome.
I don't remember. mean, that would be an amazing traction opportunity, but what a disaster for the road.
Like, In 4 to 5 years, and then they were banned, they put 25 years worth of wear on the roads. I mean, they did enormous damage. But they were great in the wintertime, man. You could, and in fact, it was so fun because you'd come to a stop sign and just brake torque it, nail the thing, and your back wheels would spin and it would send sparks out the back. It looked so awesome. But anyway, so we had incredible damage to what had been very good roads. We stopped almost all of our maintenance in 1973. Then 1979, we had another oil crisis, and that really devastated this state. And we are so far behind. If you look to the surrounding states, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, they all have spent about $1 billion every single year more on maintaining the roads and bridges than has Michigan. This has been going on since the 70s. We are literally $40 billion behind our surrounding states in maintaining our infrastructure.
And you know what every one of those states also has that we don't?
Toll roads. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Although,
right.
Although Indiana...
Really? Are they that prevalent? And all those...
They're not prevalent. They have... I know Indiana has 80, 90 going across the north. Do they have others?
I think there might be a north-south.
I don't think... Yeah. So they sold... This story, they sold the 80, 90, their toll road, to, I believe, an Australian company, which has been sold before. But that road used to be... fabulous road when Indiana took care of it. It is now almost Michigan bad. And it's been interesting to see that privatized roads get so bad. I know there have been success stories elsewhere, but my experience...
In Iowa, I know when things turned privatized, it was a disaster in multiple industries. When things were privatized, you had no accountability. You couldn't vote somebody out for bad service.
Or someone in if they promised to fix the roads.
Right, right.
Hey, look, we could go on all night, but I got to let the crew go home, so let's wrap it up. But thanks, guys. Really good having you here.
Thank you.